on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Friday, October 12th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Phil Chang. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and also to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
So, good evening. It is 5:07 and time for another hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We'll also be bringing you our regular segments, Simply Science and Dietetic Intuition.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club right here on News 101, your source for independent news. Today we'll start with our science segment. Here is Sarah Chow with Simply Science.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. This week, we have a special edition of Simply Science. Joining me in the studio today are Megan Callahan and Martha Isak. Both are science graduate students here at UBC, as well as science storytellers. Megan and Martha are here today because the video they produced, directed and shot, along with Colin Mahoney and Yoshi Watanabe, got picked up by the New York Times blog and mentioned in USA Today. Here's an audio clip from their video.
Hey, did you hear how there's all these species that are going extinct due to habitat loss? It's really sad.
Yeah, but there are millions of species. What do a few matter anyway?
Thank you, Megan and Martha, for joining us today. So, because this is radio, can you please describe the video to our listeners?
I guess just in short, our video is kind of a 1 minute. It was set up as sort of a Mythbuster-esque theme, where basically our myth is the sense that it's okay if a few species go extinct. There's millions out there, and we wanted to kind of indicate this for this kind of domino effect or this interconnectedness of all the species using a bunch of dominoes falling over and eventually affecting all species, including humans as well.
So this video came out of a video production workshop that took place right here at UBC. Can you tell us a little bit about the workshop and how you found out about it?
So the video workshop was put on by a couple of different groups, including TerraWeb, which I'm actually a member of. And it brought in Randy Olson, who's a filmmaker. And it was a 3-day intensive workshop where basically we learned everything from how to write a script to how to edit and how to put a video together, one that's focused on science and trying to communicate that science to a more general audience.
So Randy Olson is scientist turned filmmaker. What was it like to work with someone so big?
I'd actually met Randy in March, I believe. He was here for a TerraWeb seminar then. And I've worked with other filmmakers from National Geographic, and I think Randy definitely had a different style, much more Hollywood, much more broad audience, whereas some of the people I've worked with have been geared more towards an audience that's already interested in science.
Where did you get the idea for the video?
Well, that was me. I mean, in all my work, I've really kind of been interested in animal-human interactions and relationships. And when Randy suggested kind of this, you know, Mythbuster, I was looking for something that sort of had to do with that. But that being said, you know, the group as a whole definitely helped shape and create this project. You know, we talked about it, and we even had whole class meetings where the whole class got to talk about it and give their suggestions. And so it really came together as a group project.
Yeah, so Megan's idea started out with somebody sitting at a table, and then there's a semicircle of dominoes around them. And, I mean, that's not what happened in the video. Instead, the dominoes, someone knocks them down. They go out the door. They go into the forest, into streams, like, across bridges and, like, on the ice. So we definitely, like, took your idea. I'm not sure, like, whose suggestion it was for things to be outside, but it just kind of happened when we were discussing it.
Might have been Collins to give him full credit. But yes, I was thinking nice and easy, and we didn't take the easy route, but I think that was a good decision.
Yeah.
Did you come across any problems putting up the dominoes?
Oh, yes.
We have bloopers that, like, Colin's swearing about it.
Yeah, I mean, basically they fall down when you don't want them to fall down, or then you try to knock them down and they get halfway and stop. And it was a long, long process.
Oh, yeah.
So both of you are science graduate students doing research and all that. So what got each of you interested in science video production?
Well, for me, it was something incredibly new. And that's why I kind of like this TerraWeb, is it's looking at a whole different range of ways of communication. And I'd never actually done a video production workshop, I think, which is kind of the opposite of what Martha had been there. But I thought it was a great experience.
Yeah, I'd done a bit of video stuff before. So right after I finished my undergrad, I did two courses at the Banfield Marine Sciences Center, one in science journalism and the other in scientific filmmaking. And so I'd done some filmmaking. It was mainly teaching us about techniques and then learning how to put together a documentary and tell a story. So for me, I really wanted to push myself to learn to use different editing software. So the group was lucky, and I was really glad that the group let me be the editor so that I could learn how to use the software and, you know, just improve my skills with that.
The group was very glad you were the editor.
I didn't sleep much.
So how did you guys react when you found out that the New York Times and USA Today picked up your video? How did you find out?
I guess it was through an email. Was the first TerraWeb sent us out some emails about it. I think I had to go check it immediately because I was like, is this right? Are you sure about this? It was pretty amazing. I was not expecting that coming out of that workshop.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. It was also exciting to hear that Randy thought our group had really come together, because I thought it was a really positive group experience.
Oh, yeah.
I think, you know, sometimes you work in a group and then there's one person who's kind of, like, not with it, but everyone was really with it and really committed to making it work.
Yeah.
And so it was a really positive experience, and it's really nice that we were sort of able to share and extend that positive experience with other people.
Why do you think film is a good media for science communication?
I think video is a great way to communicate science, especially to the public. A lot of the scientists I know, the reason why they got into science was from watching films. So without David Attenborough and BBC Nature Films, I probably wouldn't be a scientist. And so I think it's a really great way to engage people. I think writing about science is fantastic, but one of the problems is that people who aren't interested in science might not go to the effort to read something about science. So video's nice because you can sit back and watch, and it takes a lot more effort on the part of the people producing the video to come up with something that will engage people. But I think you can really get through to more than just their mind. It gets the audience not just thinking about science, but feeling something towards it and mm-hmm. feeling a connection towards nature or whatever scientific topic you're talking about.
So as scientists and science graduate students, do you think science communication is important?
I think science communication is incredibly important because, you know, as scientists, many really want to let people know what they're doing, to make a change, to make a difference. And in order to do that, people need to know what they're doing. And you know, with all these new forms of communication, you know, it's making movies, pretty much everything, you know, all these new things that we haven't even discovered or developed yet. It's just really great opportunities to get people's message out there and for scientists to really attempt to, you know, make this change or make a difference.
So personally, I think scientists have an obligation to communicate the results of their research to the public. Most science is publicly funded, and so I think it's important for scientists to, you know, communicate the results back to the public and justify why it is that we have scientists, why we pay them. And with current funding cuts to science, I think that's even more important these days.
So what's next for both of you, future Hollywood directors, filmmakers?
Oh dear.
I would love a job at National Geographic. if they want to give me a job film editing, I will move anywhere. And while I've been working on my thesis, I've also been making videos about the research that I do. And so I study song sparrows, and I'm working on a documentary about why, even though song sparrows aren't endangered, we still actually have spent a lot of time and energy studying them. And so we've actually learned some things from them that teach us about conservation research, even though they aren't endangered. And so the documentary that I'm working on is about the long-term research project that I am currently a part of.
And where can we expect to see this documentary?
I'm not sure, I guess. I'm going to work on figuring that out in the next little while.
Cool.
For me, it's mostly thesis is the...
Oh, gosh.
The future step.
I should really do that.
I know, I'm thinking like tiny little bit.
All right, once I finish my thesis.
There we go. Then we can, then we can move that. On.
All right. Well, thank you, ladies, for coming out and sharing your story with us today. And if you'd like to check out their video, please check out the CITR Facebook page. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
So thank you, Sarah, for that Simply Science segment. Again, that was Sarah Chow and her guests Megan and Martha talking about their investigative video on science communication. You can listen to that once again on our website, citr.ca/news, as well as on our Facebook page. And now we move on to UBC campus and local headlines.
We now give you an update on the job action occurring on the UBC campus. On Wednesday, the UBC newspaper reported that UBC has reached a tentative agreement with CUPE 2950, the union that represents library and clerical workers on campus. The union had scheduled a strike vote for October 25th, but that meeting will now be used as a vote to ratify the collective agreement. Leslie Hodson, the CUPE 2950 administrative assistant, said the tentative agreement was a relief, though not exactly what the union was hoping for. The tentative agreement includes a 2% wage increase, backdated to April 1st, 2012, and another 2% wage increase on April 1st, 2013. Hodson said it was likely that the union would ratify the tentative agreement. On Thursday, job action on campus continued to intensify for the QP 116 Service and Support Union, which began a limited job action on October 4th and which represents more than 2,000 employees in trades, food services, student housing, parking, research labs, and more. The custodial and trade staffs walked off the job, an overtime ban was enacted, and a
the comments were some of the most revealing Harper has made in his connection with the landmark of CNOOC deal, which has raised fears over Chinese state-owned enterprises buying up Canadian energy assets. Some members of Canada's Governing Conservative Party are wary of the CNOOC bid, in part because of what they say are unfair Chinese business practices. Harper, speaking to the reporters in Dakar, Senegal, said that Canada wants a growing relationship with China, but added that the Chinese investments must be scrutinized from a national security perspective. This week, Ottawa has hinted strongly that it would exclude Chinese telecommunications equipment giant Huawei Technologies Limited from participating in the construction of a secure Canadian government communications network because of security risk. Harper asked about Huawei and the CNOOC takeover, began his answer by saying that he would not comment on any particular transactions. But in his subsequent remarks, he clearly touched upon both cases. Harper said, quote, the relationship with China is important. At the same time, it is very complex. It is complex because the Chinese obviously have very different systems than we do, economic and political. And that's why, obviously, some of these particular transactions raise concerns, end quote.
Canada's Food Inspection Agency will allow the XL Foods plant in Alberta, which produced the tainted beef that triggered one of the biggest meat recalls in Canadian history, to resume limited meat processing only on Thursday. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency, CFIA, said no meat will be allowed to leave the plant for now and that it will be adding extra inspectors to close monitor the company's plans to improve food safety at the plant, which had slaughtered 40% of all Canadian cattle. The CFIA suspended the Brooks, Alberta plant's operating license on September 27th due to an expanded recall of millions of pounds of beef suspected of being contaminated with E. coli bacteria. At least 12 people in Canada are recovering from eating meat contaminated with E. coli. The resumption of limited processing only marks the next stage in a review of XL's improvements to the plant, said Harpreet Kochar, the executive director of Western Operations at CFIA. For now, the XL plant will only process about 5,000 carcasses that were in the plant prior to its closure and that have tested negative for E. coli. CFIA has added temporary 2 inspectors to boost oversight at the plant and gave no timeline for the plant resuming operations. And those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101. It is now time for our weekend weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Over to you, Phil.
All right. Thanks, CJ. So for some time now, there's been a series of media coverage about the abnormal dry spell we've been experiencing here in Vancouver this summer. In August, we only had 2.9 millimeters of rain, and last month's total precipitation, an underwhelming 5 millimeter, broke an 116-year-old record and is now officially the driest Vancouver September in recorded history. Just for reference, over those 2 months, Vancouver would normally expect well over 80 millimeters. So while I'm sure many citizens, myself included, appreciated the beautiful blue skies and the sunshine, this streak of abnormal dryness has been argued by global change theorists and climate change advocates to be evident in the face of a changing world. So while that stands, long overdue, here comes the rain this weekend. As if to make up for lost time, both our rooftop and the Wharf 3 models are anticipating over 60 millimeters of rain this weekend, with up to 40 millimeters alone on Sunday. That is a lot of rain in a short period, even for Vancouver. So, listeners, I strongly urge you all to prepare accordingly. And, yeah, one other weather feature to note. As the rain is greatly cooling the surface, forcing supersaturation, watch out for a good deal of fog in the day, like even in the middle of the day, as that's uncommon, but with the amount of rain we're getting, that is very likely to happen. Great. So now here for Environment Canada's forecast of this weekend. Today, showers, fog patches, high of 12. Tonight, rain, 10 millimeters, fog patches, temperatures steady near 11. Saturday, also rainy, amount 20 to 30 millimeter, high of 14. Sunday, rain, low of 12, high of 15. So interesting they didn't disclose the amount, but again, just a heads up, Sunday on our model is when the rain is going to be heaviest, so be prepared if you would like to stay dry. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club.
Thank you very much, Phil. I guess it is going to be very rainy, but that's what happens when you live in Vancouver.
True that.
All right, so we now go to our international headlines brought to you by Democracy Now!
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman on our 100-city tour today, broadcasting from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Vice President Joe Biden and Republican Congress member and vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan squared off in the first and only vice presidential debate Thursday night with a series of lively exchanges over domestic and foreign policy. Joe Biden was seen as playing a more aggressive role in a debate that saw sharp critiques on both sides. Topics range from Medicare and abortion to Iran. The deadly attacks on the U.S. Embassy in Libya featured prominently in the debate, with Ryan criticizing the administration over what he said was a lack of embassy security.
Imposing these devastating defense cuts, because what that does when we equivocate on our values, when we show that we're cutting our own defense, it makes us more weak. It projects weakness, and when we look weak, our adversaries are much more willing to test us. They're more brazen in their attacks, and our allies are less willing to
trust us. With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
And why is that so?
Because not a single thing he said is accurate. First of all,
be specific.
I will be very specific. Number one, this lecture on embassy security. The congressman here cut embassy security in his budget by $300 million below what we asked for, number one. So much for the embassy security piece. Number two, Governor Romney, before he knew the facts, before he even knew that our ambassador was killed, he was out making a political statement which was panned by the media around the world.
We will have more on the debate later in the show and expand it by including some third-party vice presidential candidates. The 2012 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the European Union at a time when 27-nation body is embroiled in a debt crisis that sparked mass protests in Spain and Greece. The Nobel Committee cited the EU's historical leadership, including efforts to rebuild the continent after World War II and promote stability after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. But critics note that more recently, the EU has backed crippling austerity cuts in struggling countries such as Greece, where new figures Thursday showed unemployment had risen above 25% in July. We'll have more on the Nobel Peace Prize later in the broadcast. This year's Nobel Prize for Literature went to the Chinese novelist Mo Yan. Critics accused the author of being too close to China's ruling communist government, a claim he denied Friday, saying his writing has always been on the side of the people. Turkey has defended its forced grounding of a Syrian passenger plane, saying the cargo included Russian ammunition and other military equipment bound for Damascus. Syria and Russia have both condemned Turkey's actions and denied there was anything illegal on board the plane. Turkey says it's examining cargo that it confiscated. Tensions between Syria and Turkey have been rising since mortar fire from across the Syrian border killed five Turkish civilians last week. On Thursday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland said the United States strongly supports Turkey's actions.
More broadly, we strongly support the government of Turkey's decision to inspect the plane. And while, you know, we would send you to them for more details on what they found, we would be concerned by any effort to supply military equipment to the Assad regime, because it's clearly being used by the regime against their own people.
$14.1 billion bid for oil producer.
Turkey has sided with rebels opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Fighting over the 18-month conflict between the regime and rebel forces has displaced an estimated 300,000 Syrians, sending them fleeing into Turkey, Jordan, Iraq, and other countries. On Thursday, a Syrian refugee described the conditions at one camp in a rebel-controlled area near the Turkish border.
We are living in very difficult conditions. We are witnessing a lot of sorrow. The garbage is thrown everywhere. There are only two toilets to serve over 2,000 people. There's over 500 families here. Words can't express the hardships we live in. I challenge anyone to attempt to live here for even 2 hours.
The leader of the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah has admitted to launching an Iranian-made drone over Israel in a rare incursion into Israel's carefully controlled airspace. The unmanned drone was shot down by Israel, which regularly sends its own fighter planes over Lebanon. U.S. drone strikes killed at least 16 people in a tribal area of northwestern Pakistan Thursday and wounded a dozen others. Anonymous officials said the targets were militants at a compound. A U.S. Border Patrol agent opened fire on people throwing rocks from the Mexican side of the border, apparently killing a teenage boy. 16-year-old Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez was found dead from gunshot wounds, according to Mexican authorities. Border Patrol says they were responding to reports about smuggling when they saw two people abandon amounts of drugs and flee across the border back into Mexico Wednesday night. An agent opened fire after people started throwing rocks from the Mexican side and did not heed orders to stop. New data shows the number of people filing for jobless benefits in the United States has fallen to its lowest point in more than 4.5 years. The number of claims dropped by 30,000 last week, according to government figures. While the unexpected dip may have been partly distorted by seasonal adjustments, it comes amidst other signs of improvement in the job market that could bolster President Obama's bid for re-election. Last week, the government reported the unemployment rate had dropped to 7.8% in September, its lowest rate since Obama took office. Obama's challenger, Mitt Romney, is facing criticism over his remarks Thursday that uninsured Americans are able to have their health care paid for if they simply go to the hospital. Mitt Romney told the Columbus Dispatch newspaper, people don't die from lack of insurance, saying, quote, no, you go to the hospital, you get treated, you get care, and it's paid for, either by charity, the government, or by the hospital. We don't have people that become ill who die in their apartment because they don't have insurance, he said. In fact, a 2009 study by researchers at Harvard Medical School found 45,000 people die in the United States each year due largely to a lack of health insurance and inability to access quality care. That comes out to one death every 12 seconds. Mitt Romney's campaign has reportedly removed an endorsement from a Tennessee Congress member from its website after it was revealed the pro-life legislator had an extramarital affair with a patient and then pressured the woman to get an abortion. According to a transcript of a 2000 phone call obtained by the Huffington Post, Congressmember Scott Desjarlais told his partner, quote, you told me you'd have an abortion and now we're getting too far along without one. Desjarlais was backed by the Tea Party and has co-sponsored anti-abortion legislation, including a bill that would give 14th Amendment protections to each, quote, preborn human person. A Romney endorsement from Desjarlais posted in the spring was removed from Romney's website Thursday after a reporter asked about it. Prosecutors in Guatemala say they've detained 9 members of the military accused of killing peaceful protesters last week. 8 people were killed, 34 wounded, after the military opened fire on a group of mostly indigenous Guatemalans who blockaded a highway to protest education policy, constitutional amendments, and a massive rise in utility costs. According to the Attorney General's office, it's the first time members of the military have been prosecuted for abuses committed during a protest since the end of the Guatemalan Dirty War in 1996. activists in Puerto Rico are celebrating a key victory after a controversial gas pipeline dubbed the Death Route by its critics has been halted. A permit application for the 92-mile pipeline submitted to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was reportedly withdrawn on Thursday. Opponents said the pipeline would have devastated the environment and put residents at risk of deadly explosions. Last year, activist and biology professor Arturo Massol appeared on Democracy Now! To talk about the project.
The concern from the community point of view is the ecological damage and the risk that the pipeline will pose to over 200,000 people. It's also about the economy. It won't reduce the cost of energy. We have engineers evaluating all of the infrastructure and potential benefits, and there's no benefit for the people of Puerto Rico, economically speaking.
In East Texas, activists protesting the construction of the Keystone XL oil pipeline are continuing their attempts to block tree clearing efforts for a third week amidst reported crackdowns against journalists. Two reporters embedded with the activists were arrested and held overnight before charges against them were dropped. Activists say TransCanada, the company behind the oil pipeline, is paying local police to provide security. Two journalists from the New York Times were held in handcuffs before being released. Activists with the tar sands blockade say they're attempting to protect the environment and local water supplies from toxic tar sands oil. And a Portland, Oregon activist has been remanded into federal custody for refusing to testify before a grand jury about fellow activists in the Pacific Northwest. Leland Plant is the third activist in the region to be jailed for refusing to cooperate with a grand jury. The 24-year-old could remain in custody for 18 months for choosing to remain silent. On Wednesday, Leland Plant made a video saying she's ready to go to prison.
I view this state repression like this. The state thinks it is a black hole that can destroy whatever it wants. In reality, it is much more like a stellar nursery wherein it unintentionally creates new, strong anarchist stars. I do not look forward to what inevitably awaits me today, but I accept it. I ask that people continue to support us through this process by writing us letters, sending us books, donating, and spreading awareness. My convictions are unwavering and will not be shaken by their harassment. Today is October 10th, 2012, and I am ready to go to prison.
Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
So, thank you, Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For those international news. You can listen to their full segments on their website, democracynow.org. We're going to take a break. Please stay with us. We'll have Free Speak Radio telling us more about international news after we come back.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Australia and Canada are both countries with a whole lot of space to create some of the wildest sounds on the planet. Join your host Matthew as he explores the musical heritage of his native Australia and features fresh sounds from Canada's independent music world. That's Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music show, live Fridays from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Once again, you can listen to our segments on our website, citr.ca/news. You can also check out our podcasts on citr.ca and on iTunes. We now go to Free Speech Radio News to continue our international coverage.
Four Nigerian farmers from the oil-producing Niger Delta region were in a Netherlands court today to argue their case against the multinational oil company Shell. The farmers alleged that pollution from Shell's activities affected their farmlands and fishing ponds and denied them their livelihood. The case marks the first time a Dutch multinational is being sued at home in connection with pollution caused abroad, and it comes a little more than a week after the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case against Shell for alleged involvement in acts of torture in Nigeria. The case at The Hague could set a precedent which would make it possible for multinational companies to be sued at home for pollution caused in other countries. FSRN Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The farmers are in a civil court in The Hague challenging Shell for oil spills that occurred in their various villages in the Niger Delta more than 7 years ago. Alale Efanga, whose fish farm was affected in 2005, says even though Shell says it has cleared the spill, he has not been able to use the pond because it is still contaminated.
Now, after the oil spill, I thought maybe after 1 or 2 years, the place will be okay because they claim that they have cleaned up. So when I went on for just to let me see if I can bring back the fish pond, we still saw traces of oil. Oil are still there. So we cannot put fingerlings there again. So we are only waiting. We don't know when the oil will dry off from there. Nobody can do fish farming there again. So long as the oil is still there.
In Efanga's village of Oruma, children play in a stream. Villagers say this stream and all other water bodies were polluted by the oil spill. Most people in the village rely on fishing for their livelihood. Eric Doe, another farmer involved in the case against Shell, said his Ogoni homeland is still suffering the impact of the oil spill.
Communities in Ogoni land have been badly contaminated. Some communities are deserted, like my community, Goi, in Ogoni land, had been deserted as a result of devastation of the ecosystem and our environment.
According to environmental groups like Friends of the Earth, the Niger Delta has experienced the highest number of oil spills in the world. Many of the spills are blamed on Shell, the largest multinational oil company operating in the region. But Shell denies the charges and accuses local communities of puncturing its oil pipelines. Mutiu Sumonu is Shell's managing director in Nigeria.
A lot of our spills are occurring because of violence and vandalism. A lot are occurring because of crude oil theft.
But even where it is proven that Shell is responsible for oil spills, the company hardly pays compensation to local communities. Most times, the company exploits Nigeria's slow judicial system to delay cases against it. Some cases have lasted more than 20 years. This prompted the farmers to seek justice in the Netherlands. A positive outcome of the case for the farmers may encourage other people impacted by oil spills caused by Shell's operations to file charges against the corporation in Dutch courts. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
In Puerto Rico, the government has canceled plans to build a controversial natural gas pipeline that was set to crisscross the island and has drawn protests from local residents, scientists, and environmentalists. On Thursday, officials withdrew a request to the Army Corps of Engineers to build the 92-mile pipeline. According to the Spanish-language press El Nuevo Día, officials said the decision was based on finances. So far, the government has invested $50 million on the project. But many residents of Puerto Rico said the pipeline would have damaged sensitive environmental areas and threatened local communities, and they questioned the use of limited funds for a project that was expected to benefit associates of Governor Luis Fortuño. For more, we're joined by Arturo Masol. He's a professor of biology at the University of Puerto Rico and spokesperson with Casa Pueblo, one of the community groups critical of the Villa Verde pipeline project. Welcome to FSRN.
A pleasure to be with you.
In announcing the latest move, the president of Puerto Rico's Electric Energy Authority said that this would close the chapter on the Villa Verde project. What's your reaction to this latest move?
Well, actually, it wasn't a volunteer action. It had been community groups, professional groups, and different sectors of the society, Puerto Rican civil society, that got organized and have been pushing the government to withdraw the application. There was a lot of arguments by the governor to try to sustain the application after the election, but they couldn't go through. Too much pressure from the community, and finally we can claim that communities can get organized and succeed, achieve victories like the one we just got yesterday in Puerto Rico.
And just to be clear, Puerto Rican officials have said that this closes the chapter. Could it be restarted in some way?
It could be presented again, and it will have to start from the very beginning. But Villa Verde, the one that was presented, and the different communities were challenging, had been declared dead.
As you're describing, this project did come under a lot of criticism from and concern from local communities, environmentalists, scientists. Now, the 92-mile route would have cut through the central mountain chain. How would it have affected communities and biodiversity along the route?
We're talking about at least 234 rivers. We're talking about major damages to forest in critical hydrological areas, at least 32 endangered species were going to be impacted, and Puerto Rico is heavily populated, so the pipeline was designed to go through heavily dense sectors, putting at risk more than 200,000 people.
And according to an assessment done by your organization, Casa Pueblo, also there was concern about water, that the pipeline would cut through an area that produces one quarter of the water for the island.
That's true. So you know, this, Puerto Rico is blessed because we have plenty of rainwater and we have critical forest that produces a lot of water. And the government, instead of protecting that land, instead of giving the right value to those ecological services, they were presenting a proposal that was very negative for the well-being of the people, because our water resources were going to be compromised.
What about the issue of corruption? According to the Associated Press, an investigation they did, there was a contract awarded in a no-bid process to a company with ties to Governor Luis Fortuño, and the company did not have experience in this kind of construction. What about corruption?
Not only one contract. We're talking about four or five contracts given to friends of the governor without bid, without any open process, even before a state of emergency that the governor declared to facilitate an expedite process of doing things like that. It's a matter of investigating to point out responsible parties and claim responsibilities, because someone has to pay for all the damage down to Puerto Rico. Basically, we're in an economical crisis, and instead of investing our money in solving issues, this money went to the pocket of the friends of the governor, and that's not the right thing to do.
Arturo Masol is a professor of biology at the University of Puerto Rico. He's also with Casa Pueblo. He joined us to discuss the decision by the Puerto Rican government to abandon plans to build a controversial gas pipeline called Villa Verde. Arturo Masol, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
So thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that is our program for today, Friday, October 12, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to our segments on Mixcloud. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Phil Chang. Today's show was produced by Chirag Mahajan from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening.
Stay tuned for Stranded with your host Matt right here on CITR 101.9 FM.